Good day, everyone, and welcome to today's program. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, you will have the opportunity to ask questions during the question-and-answer session. You may register to ask a question at any time by pressing the star and one on your touch-tone phone. You may withdraw yourself from the queue by pressing the pound key. Please note, this call is being recorded. It is now my pleasure to turn the conference over to Mary Giovanoli. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Hi, I'm Mary Giovanoli. I'm the director of the Immigration Policy Center at the American Immigration Council. Thank you for joining us this afternoon as we look at another key issue in the current immigration reform debate, which is, in fact, about the border. And I think as many people know, or at least as many people think, the equation for ending illegal immigration always seems to point to increased border security. For many years, some of the only legislation on immigration that Congress has been reliably able to pass are budget increases for more border security. So as we prepare to debate immigration reform in the Senate with a proposal that conditions legalization for the 11 million on further enhancements at the border, it's worth taking a look at that assumption and at the actual state of border security and its relation to immigration reform. Is there a difference between border safety and border security? Do we need to refine our understanding of border policy and border issues? Is there an opportunity in the discussion to come to really rethink what the border means and how to best protect it and protect the country? To help us explore those questions, three distinguished panelists are joining us today. Our first speaker will be Terry Goddard, the former Arizona Attorney General, an expert on white-collar crime along the border, and an IPC fellow. Terry will explore the need to redefine the issues along the border in terms of going after the cartels, the sophisticated smuggling and white-collar crime that's taking place, and other mechanisms that are part of the real issues of border control. His series, How to Fix a Broken Border, explores those issues in more detail, and it's available on our website on the front page at immigrationpolicy.org. After Terry, David Shirk, who's an associate professor in political science and international relations at the University of San Diego and the director of the Transborder Institute there, will lay out his analysis on how immigration reform itself can actually help us achieve real border security. David is a prolific author, including a piece for IPC with Eric Olson of the Wilson Center entitled, Is More Getting Us Less? Real Solutions for Securing the Border. That's also available at immigrationpolicy.org. Our final speaker will be Sue Kim, an advocacy associate at the American Immigration Lawyers Association. Sue is the co-author with Greg Chen of a new report out of ALA called Border Security, Moving Beyond Past Benchmarks, that looks at border proposals and past bills and how those issues have already, the metrics that have been laid out have often already been met. It's available at ALA.org/border. When the speakers are done, they'll each talk for about 5 to 6 minutes, and then we'll open the floor up to Q&A, and we'll get the operator back on to help everybody get reoriented to that. So without further ado, let's get started with Terry Goddard.
Thank you, Mary. I'm so pleased to see the progress that Congress is finally beginning to make on border security that I hate to raise any questions, but I've been here on the border too long as Arizona's Attorney General and as an interested and involved citizen to sort of let some of the assumptions lay where they appear to be right now. I'm most disturbed about the provisions, the so-called trigger, that basically says we're going to secure the border before we move on any other aspects of immigration reform. My biggest problem with that is we've never defined what secure the border means through all of this debate. I don't think either side has done a very good job of that. And with an undefined term, it's possible for any possible interpretation. And so I would hope that we would immediately move from the general to the specific and say, okay, what does it take to secure a border? What does that mean? The second part of the proposal of the group of eight that concerns me is who is going to determine that the border is secure. It proposes a group of attorneys general and governors from the border, and one in particular, who I know particularly well, the governor of Arizona, has been impossible to solve or to satisfy on this issue. Back when we were first starting the buildup of the Border Patrol, she demanded 250 more Border Patrol just for the Arizona section. President Obama provided 500. And she said it wasn't enough. So, you know, getting Governor Brewer online is going to be extremely difficult, especially if there's no definition of what security means. And to look at that, we've spent so much time on the border discussing security in terms that only relate to people. The increase in Border Patrol has to do specifically with going after illegal crossers. I think we need a much larger matrix because whoever can prove a negative, basically we're saying that we've been successful based on the decline in the number of people being arrested. That doesn't make a whole lot of sense in an environment where our opponent, the cartels who are bringing people across, keep getting more and more sophisticated. So obviously we need to, and more will be said about this, we need to move into looking at other provisions of security and safety, including the lack of violent crime on the border itself, on the American side. And I think that speaks volumes about what is or is not happening, because some of the safest cities in America right now are right on the border. Another problem that I've developed is this, with this two-step process, is that border reform can do a lot to help make the border more safe. And I know David's going to say a great deal about that. But just as a general rule in law enforcement, and the AGs are preparing to do something publicly about this, by reducing the flood of workers coming across, you reduce the cover that the criminals tend to hide in, and you have a better identification of who, in fact, is coming into this country, when right now the problem is that all you know for sure is when you arrest somebody or you find somebody the victim of an accident or a crime, you know who they're not because of all the illegal identification that they have, not who they are. So I want to focus, however, on what else we need to do to secure the border, because the focus on just people has taken our eye off of everything else that's happening down there, the smuggling of drugs, the smuggling of contraband, and most important, the smuggling back into Mexico of dollars, of currency. Estimate between $30 and $50 billion gets moved each year from the United States to the cartel pocketbooks. Even in the best year, Homeland Security and the Justice Department have been able to seize somewhere between $200 and $300 million. That's less than 1%, quite a bit less than 1%, and I don't think there's any opportunity, any action in the world that would say that was successful. So the number one thing that needs to be beefed up is our ability to intercept money that's being laundered and sent back across the border. The reason the cartels are so good at beating our defenses, the reason that they can move people virtually at will across the border illegally, and contraband and drugs as well, is because they have fabulous technology. They're able to pay for it. Money is literally no object, no prevention for them coming and beating us up on the border. And until we stop that flood of cash, we're going to have a very hard time truly having a secure border. So Treasury has to be more involved in what is being done. We need to stop the stored value instruments, which are still not regulated in crossing the border. We need to make sure that basic money anti-money laundering provisions at the banks and at the other money transmitters are being followed. The horrible example that we've just had of abuse of ignoring any anti laundering provisions is something that simply has to stop. And the fact that nobody went to jail for those provisions, of those violations of our anti-money laundering provisions, simply has to stop as well. And until some high-level people in the financial institutions actually face criminal sanctions, we're going to have a very hard time truly having a secure border. Mary, thank you very much. I'd be happy to take questions later.
Thank you so much, Terry, and I'm sure there will be questions in a few minutes. But for now, let's go to David, and let's explore a little bit more that issue that immigration reform itself can actually help to reduce the border issues that exist.
Yeah, what Eric and I talked about in our piece is more getting us less. The point that we try to make is that what we really need are wider gates, not higher walls. The reason we have this sense that the border is out of control, that it's a lawless place, is because tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people cross the border without proper authorization, without proper documentation, because they have no alternative. Effectively, there is no legal means, no legitimate means for them to obtain a visa in a timely way, in an efficient way, so that they can come into the United States to work or spend time with their families. That has been the reality on the border for the last three, four decades, ever since we began to establish quotas for countries here in the Americas, particularly from Mexico and Central America, countries that traditionally were not subject to U.S. immigration quota laws. We have not met the demand for visas and for workers that exists on either side of the border. In other words, there are more people who want to come here and more people who want to hire those people than we allow according to our visa system. So one of the things that we discuss is the need for a more flexible, more open system for people to enter the country. That's part of the comprehensive immigration discussion and debate. If you moved people from in between the ports of entry, which is where tens of thousands of people enter through the use of smugglers or by walking across the border in less inhabited zones or by tunneling under the border. If you moved people out of those shadows and into the properly documented system for entry through regular ports of entry, you would do a great deal to help alleviate some of the problems that the Attorney General just mentioned. One of the things that we've observed over the last 10, 20 years is that organized crime groups have actually been empowered by and enriched by their ability to prey upon individuals seeking migrant smugglers. 20 years ago, you had more of a mom-and-pop kind of industry of people smugglers and coyotes. But over time, as it became more difficult for people to enter the country, as we tightened border security, it actually, made it more lucrative and for organized crime groups to enter into that illicit industry. And now, all along the border, the groups that benefit from migrant smuggling and control migrant smuggling are fairly sophisticated organized crime networks. They take $1,000, $2,000, $3,000 a pop for each migrant that they smuggle into the country, often in hideously dangerous conditions. And if we took away this revenue source from the cartels and organized crime groups along the border, we'd go a long way to weakening those organizations. But in order to do that, we've got to provide a legal means and an efficient means for ordinary workers, people who are low-skilled workers in many cases, who want to come into our economy and who are needed in our economy. We've got to make it easier for them to do that, and that really means not building higher walls, but wider gates and ways that people can enter in legally. The last thing I want to say is, we tend to think about the border at the forefront of this debate, and the border is neither the first nor the last line of defense, despite the characterization that we sometimes hear. The problems that we're dealing with along the border, whether it's drugs or immigration, these are problems that neither start at the border nor end at the border. And so in a lot of ways, we need to be looking at the sources and root causes of the problems we're dealing with before they get to the border. Otherwise, we're not going to really be able to resolve those issues.
Thank you so much, David, and I think that's a great segue really into our next speaker, Sue Kim, who's able to really look a little bit more at what proposals there have been in the past, how we've met them, and why simply sort of layering more money and resources onto border control to stop illegal immigration isn't actually the answer that we need. Sue?
Thanks, Mary. And I think Terry and David painted a great overview of why there's a need right now to look at past proposals. And I think Mary prefaced this discussion really well in saying that there is an opportunity here to redefine understanding on what border security is, or even, as Terry mentioned, to establish a definition that we can move forward with. And what ALIS report has done is we looked at past immigration reform proposals. So the past CIR, Comprehensive Immigration Reform Bills in 2006, 2007, and 2010. And it kind of breaks down the requirements, or in the case of the 2007 bill, triggers that are border related. And I think as Terry has pointed out, the benchmarks have been very people focused. It talks about border personnel and the increase of it. It talks about what are the technologies, what are the infrastructure in terms of fencing that is needed to keep people out, and in terms of apprehensions. So in one example I think has been spoken of a lot in the media is the increase of personnel on the border in terms of border patrol. And what is interesting is that each of these proposals, even though they haven't passed, they failed to become law, the metrics and the benchmarks that were laid out, each of them have been met. So if we take one example of the border personnel, the 2006 bill actually mandated that Border Patrol increase its agents by a substantial amount. I think it was every year 2,000 to 2,400 every year. And even the 2007 bill had an increase of 20,000 to 20,000, and the 2010 bill to 21,000. And while the accompanying legislation with legalization and the other provisions didn't become law, each of these benchmarks have been met, so that now we currently have an over of 21,000 Border Patrol agents. And looking at past proposals and just tying into the discussion of, there is so much that has been done in terms of pouring resources into the border without, as David mentioned, not looking at the sources, not looking and really delving into the root causes of why there is a need to address border security. And I think, again, just tying all the discussions together, there is so much about border security, as Terry mentioned, the contraband of smuggling, so much that goes into having a full discussion on border security that can't be addressed through the immigration lens. And immigration reform can't begin to cover all of border security, and I think the expectation is that we shouldn't try. So I think it's just kind of wrapping up the discussion, and our report really encourages that is for lawmakers to think about, as they move forward, how do you identify clear and reasonable border security goals that are really defined by current realities at the border and not just based on past proposals of more manpower, more fences, just more money into the border. And I think there are positive signs that even lawmakers are moving into that. And so I'll leave it at that, and thank you, Mary.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Sue. Let me just remind everybody that both David and Terry's papers are available at the IPC website at immigrationpolicy.org, and Sue's paper is available on the American Immigration Lawyer Association website, aila.org/border. So now we can turn it over to questions, and operator, if you wouldn't mind reminding people how to jump in.
Certainly. At this time, if you have a question, please press star and 1 on your touch tone phone. You may withdraw yourself from the queue at any time by pressing the pound key. Again, it's star and 1 to ask a question, and I'll pause for a moment to allow questions to enter the queue. And again, it's star and 1 to ask a question. We will go first to the side of Cynthia Marino with Vita and El Valley. Please go ahead.
Hi. I want to thank you all for the information that you provided. I have both a comment and a question. First, my comment is that I've reported a lot extensively in Mexico. I've interviewed people who have crossed the border, both legally and illegally. And one of the things I was wondering if, particularly for David Shirk, if you explored the corruption that happens on this side of the border. I know there's a lot of mention on organized crime and the drugs, but we have to think that if the root causes of all that And if it's coming here in the United States, there has to be some sort of corruption or system here that's going on. So I'm wondering if you guys have done any investigations on that. I know from some of the people that I've interviewed, they've said it's pretty easy to get across. They make deals with some of the border agents, and they're able to come across. So I'm wondering if you can talk to that, if you've done any research on that.
Yeah, I think that especially what we saw in the relocation of Border Patrol and sort of the creation of the new umbrella under DHS, the accumulation of new Border Patrol agents, essentially the doubling of Border Patrol agents from 2000 to 2010 that Sue mentioned, we saw serious problems of integrity on the part of U.S. Border on the part of the U.S. Border Patrol. It was a major issue. We're bringing in a lot of new agents, brought in some bad apples into the force. Whenever out of every 1,000 people, there's at least one bad apple that made it through the vetting and screening process, and then the process for investigating and acting against agents that are involved in corrupt practices is a fairly lengthy process. You have to gather a lot of evidence, et cetera. So suffice to say, I do think that corruption has been an issue and abuse, also taking advantage of undocumented immigrants, and not just along the border. But I don't think that those problems of corruption are so widespread and so grave that they have seriously undermined the efforts of border authorities, the Border Patrol, of ICE, and other agencies working along the border to assert control over the border. It's certainly something that I think needs to be looked at. There really needs to be a more effective process, in my view, for internal investigations, not only of corruption matters, but also of abuses. The other problem that that I think a lot of human rights groups have pointed to is the privatization of certain aspects of our immigration control system, particularly the privatization of the detention facilities that migrants are sent to, which are totally unregulated because they are private entities that essentially serve as independent contractors with DHS. So the accountability question and the integrity question, I think, is definitely there. We've looked at this. We actually submitted a grant to NIJ to evaluate the problem. It was unfortunately not funded. I think there needs to be more attention to the problem, but I don't think it's a deal breaker, if you will, on securing the border.
Okay. Thanks so much, David. I understand there's more questions coming. So can we go to our next guest?
Certainly. We will go next to the site of Brian Bennett with Los Angeles Times. Please go ahead.
Hi, this is Brian Bennett from the LA Times. This is a question for Terry Goddard, but anyone else could answer it as well. Terry, you mentioned that the drug smugglers have a lot of technology they use. Could you briefly describe what kind of technology they do use, and if you think that there are technologies that U.S. Border Patrol agents could have at their fingertips that would help them stop more of the trafficking, especially in light of the fact that more than $1 billion has already been spent on trying to ramp up technology that had mixed results?
Yeah, good question, and it gets me back to the money. With money today in the technology area, virtually anything is possible, and we're kidding ourselves if we think not. So every time we get a terrific mousetrap, they invent a way around it. And I think that's the fundamental problem of letting billions of dollars back through our money laundering protections. In other words, we're getting such a trivial amount in all of the various border security efforts of the total take from drugs and human smuggling that the cartels are able to match whatever we do technologically and then try to evade it. And they're, from my experience, they're incredibly good at that. What are they doing? Virtually everything. They've got great secure communications. They've got real-time reporting from the border, from visual observation. They've got night vision devices, so they never have to turn on a light. They've got various cloaking mechanisms that are military in their origin but have become commercial and are used by the cartels to smuggle drugs, which somehow in this immigration debate, the drugs and contraband have sort of gotten lost. You don't hear that much about them except to see that the price of drugs illegally is dropping still on the street. And so there must be major holes that are being exploited in our border security. What can we do to beat it? I frankly give high marks to the Border Patrol. We've got great scanners that can take a whole truck in a few seconds and tell you what's inside of it. Certainly more of those would be useful. We still don't have interoperability on the border, something that the Gang of Eight has referred to. Wow, that's way over time when local and state police can't talk to the federals and the federals can't talk to each other. Some of the tragic killings of Border Patrol agents have been a result of non-communication. So we better whip that one. But the fundamental issue, I think, remains, and that is as long as we don't stop the money, they're going to continue to beat us on technology because it's much easier to get around a system than it is to devise it in the first place. And they're going to corrupt agents in the field. The last question, I think, is an important one. Although it's not a fundamental flaw, it is an increasing problem. With huge amounts of money being spent on getting through our border protection, obviously they're going to go after trying to corrupt border officials. And with almost unlimited funds, they're going to do it.
Thanks, Terry. I understand there are more questions. So who's next?
We'll go next to the side of Michelle Lederman with El Latino Newspaper. Please go ahead.
Thank you so much for taking my call, and thank you for this conference call. My question is, I think there's an agreement that border safety and border security are a condition to get any immigration reform approved. The question to the panelists is, what would you recommend to Congress, what steps would you recommend to Congress to take to make those borders safe and secure?
Terrific question. Who wants to go first?
Well, I'd be happy to take a shot at it because I would start with getting serious about enforcing our anti-money laundering laws and cracking down on the huge transfer of funds that continues to go across the border. We all saw just recently the settlement with HSBC, over hundreds of millions of dollars, and we all know that there was more involved, but that's how much was admitted. That slipped through the fingers into the illegally to across the border. Nobody went to jail for that, so I would also say we need to increase the criminal penalties for violating anti-money laundering provisions. As long as it's just a cost of doing business for the financial institutions, frankly, it's going to be violated with impunity, as it has been. So that's number one. And there are many parts to that that I deal with in my paper, and I won't go into it. But I'll leave the field open for other suggestions.
What if I can jump in? This is David Shirk. I mean, one of the things that I think has been a real problem about border management generally, and also the management of border security, is that it's really we've conceptualized it always as a unilateral problem, and we've only designed unilateral solutions. We have not truly tried to set up effective governance structures and management structures and liaison mechanisms to work with our Mexican partners to enable them to help us to secure the border in ways that would be mutually beneficial. And I think that ultimately is something that is a real opportunity of the current debate on border security. If we're going to talk about a panel monitoring entities to try to determine whether there is effective progress in the management of our border, it really should be a kind of binational commission that monitors and evaluates the security and management of our border in a way that would bring a lot of data analysis and credibility to the process. So I think there are real opportunities to achieve a more secure border. One of the things that I think I would recommend to President Obama is to find a way to work with our partners in Mexico to do that. That's exactly what we do on the northern border. Canada is very closely involved in any discussions about how to secure the border. We need to do more of that with Mexico, in my view.
Well, and this is Terry Goddard. Fundamentally, let's decouple the idea that securing the border is only about people. Unfortunately, all of the solutions that get put forward, from the fence to the drones to the border patrol, is about stopping people coming across illegally. Border security involves an awful lot more than that. It involves the money. It involves the contraband. It involves the drugs. It involves violent crime on both sides of the border. And if we're going to be true, I mean, if the folks who say we want to secure the border are going to stick to their guns, let's really talk about what border security means in all of its aspects. And one way to start with a collaboration with Mexico that I certainly think is necessary and can be greatly improved is to do a multinational attack on human trafficking. We have young girls mostly being smuggled across the border in significant numbers. That's an insult to the sovereignty and to the national pride of Mexico, and I think that's one place where they can join with us in attacking the cartel's stranglehold on this illegal activity.
And I gather from the comments that people are making then that if you decouple these border issues from the immigration question, it also changes the dynamic on this notion of triggers, such that the border has to be secure before you could start a legalization process. Is that correct?
If you're going to have triggers, let's have triggers that really relate to border security. Let's have a trigger that says how much violent crime do you have in border communities. Let's have a trigger that says what kind of a job are you doing stopping the wire transfer and other transfers of huge sums of money. Let's have a trigger that relates to human trafficking, for example, and the people who are coming across the border against their will, not voluntarily. I think there are a number of things that need to be looked at other than just workers coming across the border to get a job.
Can I just jump in really quickly on the trigger question? This is David again.
Sure.
I mean, to me, at the end of the day, as a political scientist, there are only two kinds of policy problems. There are problems that you solve, and there are problems that you manage. Problems that you solve, you can say, we did it, it's done, it's been accomplished. But problems that you have to manage are longstanding, ongoing issues that have to be dealt with. And so you can set targets and you can try to achieve certain goals, but ultimately you're going to constantly have to deal with the fact that there will be people who try to come across the border. There will be threats to our security. But we shouldn't define border security by the threats we face, rather our ability to deal with them.
That's excellent. Thank you. Next question.
We'll go next to the side of Alejandro Huckel with Congressman Mark Vesey. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
You know, and actually, I just had one quick question. I missed the websites when you said papers are available. I know I got IPC.org for Terry Goddard and David Shirk, but I missed the website for Sue Kim's paper.
Sue?
Didn't you say the Sue Kim's?
Yeah.
It's at ayla.org/border.
Can you spell that out for me, please?
AILA.org/border.
And it's actually immigrationpolicy.org for the other papers.
Immigrationpolicy.org.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next question?
We'll move next to the site of Jude Jaffe Block with KJZZ. Please go ahead.
Yeah, sorry, I think that you might have started to answer my question, but I'll just ask anyway to see if you can elaborate. I'm hearing that the metrics of people isn't adequate, but I wonder, I mean, do you have an answer, you know, to the question of when will we be able to define the border as secure, even looking at these other metrics, you know, what would be the point at which that border secure label could be applied?
Sue's paper really addresses this. Sue, do you want to jump in and talk about some of the metrics that you identified looking at past bills?
Sure. And I think the summary of the paper kind of deals with the fact that it's not, and I think David made a good point, and Terry have of just the step that we take in defining border security. And I think it's kind of hard to say because I think we go into the assumption that there is a point when the border will be secure. And I think in going in, what past proposals have thought and have framed the discussion is that, you know, 100% apprehension. Or we have said, oh, when we have this many Border Patrol at every few feet, then it will be secure. And I think it's taking that framework and as a step to moving towards really discussing border security, not looking back on the past proposals. Let's not go back to the way we've always thought about border security. And I think just this call and discussions that we're having is that let's actually take the opportunity to think about some of these issues. The paper that Ayla wrote, and it's just a brief summary of what are the things that we have done and that haven't worked. They haven't fully addressed it. And so let's not make that the starting point. Let's look at the current realities on the border. So things that we have looked at that's very much outdated, and I think that one thing is operational control. We say that a lot in Congress, and even the Senate proposal has mentioned that we need to establish operational control. But what does that even mean? Does it mean that we have to seal the border, which DHS has said is not possible? Does that mean we need to keep increasing personnel on the border? Does that mean we need to build a bigger fence, a larger fence, a higher fence? And or do we need to detain more people? And I think these are metrics that have been used in the past, and we see that they don't have proven results. Like what are the actual things that we want to be able to define as secure? So I think these are good launch points of what has been done, what has been attempted, and let's move past it to current realities. And I think that's one of, I would say, is the main encouragement for the lawmakers as a next step is let's not go back to the past.
Well, and this is Terry Goddard. You know, the problem is in defining how much is enough. And every time there has been an effort to increase the Border Patrol, for example, the answer is it's not enough. Every time there is a effort to increase the physical security, the answer is however much you've done, it's not enough. So that's why I think it's desperately necessary to create some very clear guidelines that are achievable. They may be tough, but they need to be achievable rather than constantly moving the goalposts. And that has been the characteristic of this debate from the beginning. There is a note in the Senate essay on this subject that says that we must continue to facilitate commerce. There's somebody who lives on the border and in a state that desperately values imports from Mexico. Facilitating commerce is something that's been lost in the discussion quite a long time ago. The 2 and 4 to 5 hour waits to get across, the long waits for getting trucks across, it meant that much commerce is bypassing Arizona now. So this is a flexible border. It's the most trafficked in the world. And to make it viable from all of the different purposes that it has to serve, we need to keep more than just a fixation on stopping everybody that might want to come through the desert. Let me just close on the idea of a wall, which many people have said that's a metric. We have to have all 2,000 miles actually fenced or walled before we can move forward with immigration reform. Just from a law enforcement perspective, that's an absurd proposition. It's using a 12th century technology to fight a 21st century enemy because the cartels have proven over and over again they love nothing more than a physical barrier on the border. They can go under it. They can go over it. They can use drones just as well as we can, and they can go through it with plasma torches. So the idea of having one of the metrics be completing a wall on the border is simply absurd and a waste of money.
Thank you for all of those really insightful answers. Do we have another question?
Yes, and as a reminder, it's star 1 to ask a question. We'll go to the site of Reza Camargo with Foxy. Please go ahead.
I pushed a button. Oh, can I talk?
Yeah, that's you.
Hello.
We can hear you. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah, this is Charlie Erickson with Hispanic Link News Service. I'd like to get an answer from any or all of the three of you as it relates to path to citizenship. One, if you think what would be a fair solution to that, how long it would take, and two, what you think would be a reasonable idea that something might get past Congress on that.
This is Mary Giovanoli from the Immigration Policy Center. Let me jump in a little bit, and then our panelists can expand. I mean, I think that when you measure an issue like the path to citizenship, you really have to ask yourself, what's it going to take to make a program successful, and how long should people have to wait? And I think one of David's points has been, look, you know, we have an immigration system that really needs to be changed, and so we have to reduce our backlogs and allow people to move forward. So I think we have to think about it in tandem. And I don't know, David, if you would want to elaborate on that a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I think that a lot of the discussion about immigration and immigration reform right now really focuses on trying to deal with the 11 million people that are already here and finding them an option for legal residency and a path to citizenship. But to me, this is a discussion that we had, you know, 20 years ago. Almost 30 years ago, through IRCA, it's a discussion that if we just try to solve that aspect of the problem and deal with the people that are already here without trying to develop a more effective, more streamlined system for admitting people into this country, it's a problem that will return and continue to grow over the next 20 or 30 years. If we don't want people sneaking across the border or overstaying their visas, we have to make it desirable for people to present themselves to authorities rather than evade those authorities. And that it's a pretty simple idea. It will be much harder to do, but you know, we have 30, 40 different classifications of visas for temporary admittance to the United States. Why can't it be simpler? It takes months or years in order to obtain admission into the United States. And for a poor farmer that wants to feed his family and who needs to know whether he's going to have work in a couple of weeks or a couple of months, that's just not adequate. For a farmer on this side of the border who wants to hire a seasonal worker, they need a much more efficient and streamlined system to bring people into the workforce. So to me, at the end of the day, if you want to move people out of the shadows, you need to make it easier for them to move into the light.
Terrific.
Let me just add two things, because I'm, as a law enforcement or at least former law enforcement, I am concerned about the lack of community policing in the immigrant community. And that's something that citizenship is being emphasized by the Senate proposal as a reward for good citizenship. You can move on the citizenship path. I think that's critically important for the safety of our communities. We need to get people out of the shadows so that they will report crime, they will be witnesses against criminal behavior, they will not be victims themselves. And the second part is we need clear identification, because right now we have a system that encourages people to lie about who they are. And I want one, to use David's point, that people need to come forward and be clearly identified, have an identification card that makes us in law enforcement know who we're dealing with, not have to unravel an incredible maze of false identification.
Thank you. Can we take another question, please?
Can I follow up on that? I don't think anybody really – they had some interesting comments, but they didn't answer my basic question as to what's a reasonable amount of time that it might take to get citizenship with a bill that might get through Congress, and two, whether they have any personal –
Yeah, Charlie, I think that is a whole teleconference in and of itself, and we have been doing – work on that kind of issue. I think the short answer is it's hard to sort of do a number, 3 years, 5 years, 8 years. I think what's absolutely critical is that it is a path that holds out real promise of being able to be completed, so that you don't impose a lot of obstacles up front, you don't impose a lot of obstacles along the way. People have a belief that they will, in fact, be able to get there. So I think it's too soon to put an actual year level on it. And I think that I probably speak for everybody on the call when I say that the likelihood that we're going to move something through the Senate is greater than it has been in years. And I think all things point to actually getting a bill passed this year. So we're happy to connect you with the folks to have more questions about that later. But I do want to give people another chance to ask questions.
And we'll move next to the site of Samuel Acosta with the Office of Congressman Mark Vesey. Please go ahead.
Yes, my question was with Mexico's new president. I know the former president, I guess their stance on with the criminal organizations was a little different. Are we anticipating any kind of like increase from the cartels, towards trafficking into the U.S.? What are your insights on that?
Can I address that? We just released last week a report on drug violence in Mexico, looking at the data that's available through 2012. And first of all, one of the things that we saw over the last year is what seems to be a pretty significant reduction in overall drug violence, particularly along the border, places like Ciudad Juarez, which actually dropped to dropped several thousand, a couple thousand homicides down to the lowest, down to second place in among all cities in Mexico for drug-related violence for the first time in 3 years. So we've definitely seen some real changes already in the security situation along the border. The new president of Mexico, Enrique Peña Nieto, has declared that one of his central goals, in fact, his central goal on security, is to reduce levels of violence by looking at basic citizen security as opposed to going after the kingpins of these organizations. And there are a lot of analysts who believe that President Calderon actually stirred up more trouble by going after the heads of cartels and arresting them or taking them out. That led to infighting and turf wars. So it is plausible that the new president's strategy, which is looking after the best interests of ordinary citizens and trying to use more of a citizen security model, will actually lead to a reduction in violence, which I think would help to assuage some of the fears that people have about spillover violence and the violence that we've seen all along the border. The last thing I'll say, of course, is that threat of spillover violence has been astonishingly small in the last few years. We see along the border some of the safest community on the U.S. side of the border, the cities like San Diego, El Paso, that are adjacent to the border have actually been some of the safest cities in the United States. So in my own view is that drug violence is indeed something that should be a threat and something that we should be more concerned about than janitors and housekeepers crossing the border. And that's where we should really direct our border security efforts. But over the next few years, I anticipate under the new president that things may get much better, and we just have to cross our fingers. Terry may want to speak to this, I think.
Yeah, I really do, because I think we have to define what you mean by better. If what the implications of the new policy are that the cartels get stronger and more independent, I think that's very bad for the United States,
because
essentially we have an extraterritorial criminal activity that has already long since been established as the most dangerous organized crime threat in the world by our Justice Department. We certainly don't want them consolidating and diversifying. And that is, unfortunately, what I think the penalty of a hands-off policy in Mexico might be. So I'm hopeful that much of the Calderon administration effort to go after the cartels will continue. Perhaps the methods will change to one that is smarter and less direct confrontation. But you can't abandon the field. At least the U.S. shouldn't be interested in having Mexican authorities abandon the field, because as the cartels diversify, they got more and more criminal activity. They're getting into intellectual property. They're smuggling most of the software and entertainment videos that are available in Latin America, have cartel stamps on them. That's going to be far harder to roust out than the drug trade. And we're asking for serious problems if we let that happen.
I just want to say that I concur with that assessment, Terry.
Thank you.
So we've got much bigger fish to fry, I think, than on the immigration issue.
Well, and that's why immigration is such a distraction.
Yeah, exactly. I understand we have, we have time for one more question. Operator, can you let that lucky caller ask their question?
Yes, we'll go last to the side of Anne Caroline Hudeling with the MS Foundation for Women. Please go ahead.
Yeah, hi, thank you. I just want to say thanks. I've lived on the border for 9 years in Cochise County, and I loved what Terry had to say about the 12th century technology. It certainly is, and I always hearken back to the fact that it's sort of like trying to wall off the Mississippi, essentially, and I just think a lot about how we can bring that real lived experience of how really big the border is to folks that are making decisions.
Any closing thoughts on that question?
Well, this is Terry. Let me just say to at least a part-time fellow Arizonan, thank you for that. It is a huge issue. We need to be smarter, not more retroactive. And a point was made earlier that I think needs to be repeated, and that is that the border isn't a physical line in the desert. That, of course, is one level, but it is nationwide. The cartels have formed alliances with organized street gangs in virtually every major city in the United States. So their tentacles reach way past the physical line in Arizona, New Mexico, Texas, and California. And unless they're combated on the streets in those cities through their drug trade primarily, but also now in intellectual property and other contraband, and most importantly, in their access to funds, which is right now virtually unlimited, we're going to continue to fight a losing battle on the border. And unfortunately, immigration and people have distorted the discussion so much that when we say border security, many in Congress think only about stopping people. And they forget about the cartel mechanism, which makes it so possible for those people to get illegally into this country. That's what needs to be attacked. And that's a multifaceted, interdimensional attack, which needs to be taken far more seriously than it has been. It doesn't have much to do with immigration. It has to do with good financial controls. It has to do with cutting down on trade violations. It means an awful lot more than the simplistic discussion that's been taking place so far. And we need most of all to define what securing the border means.
I think that is a fine conclusion to what I hope is the beginning of a discussion for many of you on better ways to look at, think about, and talk about what real border security means, not only in the context of immigration, but in the broader sort of economic and cultural needs of the country. Let me just do a couple of quick closing items. If you have additional follow-up comments for our guests, please reach out to Wendy Sefsaf. Wendy Sefsaf-Feliz, so Wendy, W-Feliz, W-F-E-L-I-Z at Immigration Policy. I'm just having one of those days. If you're on this call, then you already have contacted Wendy with the information, so reach back out to her. It's on the media list. And thank you to all of our guests for their comments. And again, immigrationpolicy.org is the website for Terry and David's papers, and ALA.org/border is the website for Sue Kim's paper. I'm going to go put my face in ice water because it's so red right now, but thank you so much for being on the call and starting this conversation with us. Have a great day, everybody.